Conservation Committee. Chairman Morey, would you begin that meeting?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First order of business is approval of previous committee minutes from the March 28, 2012 meeting. We've already been previous. Is there a motion to approve? Committee item number one is an update on the EPWD progress in implementing the Texas Park Wildlife Park Land and Water Resources Conservation Recreation Plan. Mr. Smith, can you please make your recommendation?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Carter Smith. First and foremost, let me just say, obviously, at this point, obviously, that we had to cancel the commission retreat. Obviously, the weather was very bad, precluded us from getting in. One of the key items of business that we hope to accomplish with you was for Scott to present the recommended action items for the commission to consider and consider approving as we track the progress on the land and water plan. One of the things we want to do when Chairman Friedkin is back is get with him about how he wants to get with all of the commission to discuss those proposed items, get your input and feedback, and then make sure we have a list of action items and deliverables that the commission will be tracking at every meeting. So we look forward to those discussions with all of you. A couple of things I do want to update the commission on. First, just as a follow-up to the March briefing that our wildlife team gave with respect to the proposed migratory game bird seasons and bag limits. The decision for the early season bag limits affecting teal and dove and woodcock and gallinule and snipe, those are going to be made by the Fish and Wildlife Service at their annual regulations meeting in June. As is customary, after we hear from the Service Regulations Committee, we will come back and I'll report that to the chairman and make sure he concurs with that so we can adopt it, again, letting hunters know what's going to be expected come September, particularly again with doves and teal. We're not expecting any changes. I just wanted to remind everybody of the process. And then, in addition, as is customary in August, we'll come back to the commission and Dave Morrison will report on what the proposals are for the late season regulations. So just wanted to remind everybody about that. We talked a lot with the commission about the status of the Lesser Prairie Chicken and our concerns about the precipitous declines that we've seen throughout its range. But we've also talked a lot about just some of the extraordinary conservation work that's going on with private landowners up in the Panhandle and throughout other states. This issue has taken on more urgency as of late. Wendy Connolly briefed y'all on the lawsuit that the Wild Earth Guardians and Center for Biological Diversity had brought against Fish and Wildlife Service, compelling them to consider making a determination as to whether the listing of literally hundreds of species throughout the country was warranted. One of those species is the Lesser Prairie Chicken. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has let us know that by the 1st of September, they expect to render a decision or a proposal as to whether or not such a listing is warranted. If it is, they will then can make a recommendation as to whether or not that bird should be listed as either federally threatened or federally endangered, and at which point there'll be a year to provide additional public comments and feedback on that proposal. We have been working very diligently with the other four states in which the prairie chicken exists on coming up with a multi-state conservation plan that we will be submitting to the Fish and Wildlife Service in June. It will lay out all of the science, all of the monitoring, all of the conservation that we have been doing. Our goal, obviously, is to make a case that the bird should not be listed and that the state should continue to retain authority to be able to manage this species. Obviously, formerly a game bird species in this state, still is in Nebraska. And so we're going to be working on that, and we'll certainly apprise the commission of that front. I'd be remiss if I didn't acknowledge the work of our wildlife biologists up in the Panhandle. They have engaged private landowners through what are called voluntary candidate conservation agreements with assurances with ranchers on now almost 300,000 acres of Lesser Prairie Chicken habitat. So just extraordinary partnerships. We've got the ranching community really working well with the department on this front, showing voluntary conservation. So Wanted to let you know the status of that. Also wanted to give a brief update as to where we stand with Bastrop State Park. Could not be more proud of our state parks team. The park fully opened on April 13th. That's due in no small part to our park staff who did an extraordinary job. You had a chance to hear from our volunteer group at the last commission meeting when they made a very sizable donation to the department. They've just been extraordinary. Also, the American Youth Works, which is a nonprofit organization that has teenagers out of high school and in college that are spending their time working on rebuilding trails and bridges and roads and engaging in restoration, and they've just been phenomenal partners. But as of the 13th, all the roads were open, the campsites, the YMCA has taken on the pool there, and it's open for 7 days. A very, very active restoration program going on, but also I know will be of interest to the commission, a very active research program, looking at what the vegetative response following the fire, what are the wildlife doing in response, what's the status of the erosion. We've got some PhD students from the University of Texas involved as well. We always get asked the question, when are we going to start planting trees back in the park? We are looking at next winter, 2013. The Apache Foundation, Apache Oil Company, has graciously agreed to provide all of the trees for the first year of planting. We have another donor that we'll announce on Labor Day that we believe is going to commit to providing all of the trees for reforestation for subsequent years after the first year. So we've had a great response there from the private sector that has stepped forward to help the department. We're awfully, awfully proud of that. The last thing I want to announce about Bastrop State Park is a partnership with Coca-Cola. Each year, they have a national contest that's called America Is Your Park, and they encourage people to vote for their favorite park, national, state, or local park across the country. The park getting the most votes is awarded a very significant gift. And they have chosen Bastrop State Park to launch its national contest. And so we're looking forward to that. Liddy and her team have been working very closely with Coca-Cola, and we're excited for the park to get that kind of recognition. I now want to move on to an update on the situation that is rapidly developing out in the Trans-Pecos, having to do with chronic wasting disease. And some proposed rules that we want to put out for the public's consideration and then come back to the commission for consideration in August. Just as a point of departure, for those of you who are not familiar with chronic wasting disease, it's a fatal neurological disease. It's analogs in cattle, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or BSC is what you often hear referred to in the press. In sheep, it's scrapies. It's always fatal for animals that get it. In terms of wildlife that are susceptible to CWD, white-tailed deer, mule deer, elk, moose, sika deer, we don't have any evidence at this time to suggest that it can be transmitted through natural means to livestock or humans. The CWD has a long kind of latency or dormancy period, incubation period of anywhere between 2 to 4 years. In terms of how unaffected animals get it, it can be transmitted laterally from animal to animal through saliva or fluids, and then also through environmental exposure from contaminated sites where animal that eats vegetation and soil that have been contaminated with the prions, which is the affected protein, which is the vector for transmitting the disease. The signs of an animal once they contract the disease and once it begins to manifest itself, and you see it in this picture of this deer, emaciation, listlessness, fatigue, chronic walking around, droopy ears, it's not a pretty picture. And after an animal contracts a disease, death is imminent within a couple of months. Obviously, this causes us as wildlife managers great concerns in terms of how we manage deer throughout the state. You know, one of the things we have seen in Colorado and Wyoming, where you have areas that are impacted from CWD, is where you have high prevalence rates in a population, and by that 20, 30, 40, or 50%, then you will see a corresponding population decline even in areas that aren't being hunted or otherwise affected. Also, once CWD is detected in a population at a relatively high prevalence, not surprisingly, you see hunters start to alter their behavior and shying away from areas that have high rates of chronic wasting disease in the population. So from a wildlife management perspective, obviously this is something that gives us great pause. This map shows CWD distribution throughout North America. It's found in 19 states and provinces. You see it up there in the Prairie provinces. This map depicts areas where CWD has been detected, both in free-ranging and in captive facilities. The captive facilities are shown in a yellow circle there, and then the gray shaded areas are in free-ranging populations. One of the things I want to make sure that the commission is aware of, our wildlife division has been actively monitoring and looking for CWD, both in the wild and in breeder pens. For the last 10 years in the wild, our wildlife biologists and technicians have collected 26,556 samples. You can see this stratified by ecoregion in terms of the wild deer that have been tested. I'll call your attention to two of those ecoregions, the Trans-Pecos and the High Plains, the two areas where we have mule deer in the state, and the relatively low sample sizes in those areas. We've also worked very cooperatively with the breeder community on testing animals in breeder facilities and pens, so captive deer. And so in the 10 years that we've been involved in the testing, we've tested a little over 7,400 animals. And again, this depicts it by ecoregion. And today, I want to make this abundantly clear, we have not detected CWD through any of our tests. What has caused us recent alarm was the fact that we were notified this year by our colleagues in New Mexico that they had found three instances of mule deer that tested positive for CWD right on the Texas border in the Waco and Sacramento Mountains. They had tested 400 killed deer there in Game Management Unit number 28 on the Texas-New Mexico border. Three out of the four tested positive, and those deer were found within 1 to 2 miles of the Texas border in the Waco and Sacramento Mountains. Obviously, for those of you that are familiar with that area, there are no barriers to movement for wild deer in that area. And so obviously the concern is that infected deer could have crossed into Texas. And it's caused the wildlife conservation community great concern. And so as a response to that, we immediately began to work and reach out to our partners at the Animal Health Commission, who, by the way, have just been extraordinary in working with the department on disease-related issues. You want state agencies to work very, very well together and build on each other's strengths. We're very fortunate to have great partners at the Animal Health Commission. In fact, here today we've got the Executive Director of the Animal Health Commission, Dr. Dee Ellis, and Dr. Terry Hensley, and then their General Counsel, Gene Snelson. I just want to acknowledge you professionally very well. So just raise your hand, guys. Thank y'all for being here. Once we were notified about the presence of CWD, we did a couple of things. One, we reopened the state's CWD state plan that was published back in 2003 to see how it needed to be updated. And also, along with the Animal Health Commission, we reactivated the CWD task force, which is comprised of veterinarians and landowners and biologists and representatives from various associations to talk about what kind of actions were necessary given this very, very significant finding. The task force met and were resolute in their recommendations back that we needed to take very aggressive action to try to do everything we could to contain this disease and make sure that we did everything possible to keep it from spreading into the state or spreading throughout the state. And they had a number of recommendations that I want to share with the commission.
Carter, before, yep. before you go to the recommendations, around what city is are these two areas? Is that near Rio Doso?
So it's that area that you see on the map is east of El Paso. The closest little community on the Texas side would be a little town of Cordillas or Salt Flat, which are between the Guadalupe Mountains and El Paso, about halfway through there. Those areas, I think, were on part of the Fort Bliss range is where they were killed.
In that upper area of New Mexico, where is that? Is that, do you know?
You know, I'm going to show my geographic illiteracy, like I'm afraid most all Americans, and not being able to name any towns in close proximity to that.
Okay, that's fine.
There are not any, is that what I heard from back there? Look good sighted, whoever said that. Thank you. The task force recommended that both the Animal Health Commission and Parks and Wildlife, and that is something that we are going hand in hand with the Animal Health Commission to make sure that we have a consistency of proposed rules to our respective commissions, that we set up essentially two zones, a containment zone and a high risk zone. And the containment zone, you can see here in the red hashing, basically would be bound to the east on a state highway near the border of Culberson and Husband County, would extend west to El Paso, north of I-20, and then up to the New Mexico border. And then right now, the proposed border for the high-risk zone would essentially be east of that highway going to the Pecos River, and then again bound on the southeast and south by I-20. Inside the containment zone, the recommendations that the task force are bringing forward, you know, first that we immediately proceed with additional sampling in that area, and our biologists are already reaching out to private landowners to conduct additional sampling here in the next month just to see if there's any animals that test positive in the area or not. We want to increase our sampling. But within the containment zone, what we're proposing are, you know, first, mandatory deer hunter check stations that we'd set up there in Cordillas and Van Horn. And so all mule deer killed within that area would be required to come to those check stations and be tested. We're also thinking about how we work cooperatively and effectively with landowners that have MLDP permits, and so try to figure out how we work with them to check deer and make sure those are tested as well. Because of concerns about moving deer around in that area, our recommendation would be not to issue any triple T or DMP permits within that area. We've not had any triple T permits in that area. And also our proposal would be, I'm sorry, I should switch that slide, that we would not authorize any deer to be possessed in any new deer breeder facilities in that area. And as of now, there are no deer breeder facilities within that area. I will say that depending upon the sampling and the dynamics of this issue and whether or not we do detect any positive animals, that these zones are a little fluid and could be moved. And so in the event that there were existing breeder facilities within that containment zone, we would recommend that no movement of those deer be allowed until they've reached what we call five-year status, meaning that in a five-year period they tested all mortality of all animals in there and that there was no detection of CWD. Within the high-risk zone, what we are proposing in that area would be that there's voluntary checking of animals for CWD. We probably look at trying to set up some check stations in that area, so we could heighten our sampling effort. For those landowners that were interested in pursuing a triple T for sites within the high-risk zone, we would propose to require them to test at least 300 white-tailed deer or mule deer for CWD. There's a statistical basis for that. For a sampling level at that scale, that would give us a 95% confidence that we could detect CWD at a 1% prevalence throughout a population. So that's what the vets and others are recommending. That could be done over a multi-year period. So I want to make sure that's clear. And then again, not unlike what we mentioned in the containment zone, that for deer breeder facilities within the high-risk zone, we would look at allowing them to move deer on either a three-year or a five-year basis in terms of the testing and making sure that no deer were tested positive for CWD. Right now, at least in the high-risk zone, as we've identified it now, there's one deer breeder in that area. Mitch Lockwood has reached out to that individual and is talking to him about this issue. He's been obviously keeping up with all his testing, and we're going to make sure that we have a lot of input from him as we go forward. So what we're looking at now is to request permission to publish rules in the Texas Register to get public comment. Obviously, we'll be going out for extensive public comment on this issue, particularly in the Trans-Pecos, but we would request permission to publish rules to accomplish the following. That we be allowed to establish rules for both a containment zone and a high-risk zone, and that it would authorize the executive director to define the boundaries of the containment zone and the high-risk zone as the chronic wasting disease distribution is better defined in New Mexico and or Texas, as again is determined by the sampling that we will be increasing our efforts on. So with that, let me stop there and see if anybody has any questions. Yeah, Commissioner Scott.
A couple of them. So the strain of that stuff is the same for whitetail as mule deer?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's the same thing. Okay. So you answered one question. We don't have any breeders out there, so except for the one guy, so you really don't have any data on the how are our biologists checking the mule deer out there?
So that's a great question. I should have mentioned that. In terms of the sampling, we've been doing that through hunter-harvested deer, and also picking up roadkill deer and collecting brain samples to have them tested. Again, in the next month or so, we plan to go out in some very systematic, targeted harvesting of additional mule deer in specific locales near the New Mexico border, just to help give us a better confidence that our sampling protocol is being able to test animals adequately in and around the New Mexico border.
Well, and in that same vein, having hunted in Colorado for elk, you know, and stuff, I've had to have, you know, the brain tested and everything to get the meat and everything. How long will it take for our people, however we're proposing to do these test stations? You know, people are harvesting mule deer, you know, how long does it take? In other words, you know, you need to get the meat processed pretty quick. So if you're going to sit there and take a week to get the head checked, you know, obviously then you got another issue.
So, yeah, I think we'll be very, very sensitive to that. What we hope to do is process it very efficiently. As I understand kind of the proposal right now, we're still working on the details. So the deer brought into a check station, our biologists would go ahead and collect a sample immediately, and then that sample is going to be sent off to a lab. We then provide a tag to those individuals so that if they were stopped by a game warden in another part of the state, you know, they get clear evidence that animal had been tested, then they're free to go ahead and take that animal on to get it processed. And then we certainly notify them of the results of that test once it came back from the lab. And I can't answer how long it would take for that test to get back to the lab, but I can certainly get somebody up here to answer.
Well, I'm just looking down the road, if we go through all this and do these containments in the high-risk zones, and it goes out for public comment, and then real quick, you know, that's going to be one of the top questions because everybody's going to be saying, thinking the same thing. You know, well, if I kill the deer, you know, I can't process it. Why pay the money to go kill a deer, you know, or you can just kill your own deer as far as that goes.
So well, we certainly wouldn't be looking at any rules to preclude anybody from going ahead with processing deer. So we certainly encourage them to go forward with that. Again, no evidence to suggest that CWD can be transferred from eating the meat, and so I think folks would just continue on down the highway and going back to wherever they were going, and process it themselves or take it to a processor.
Okay.
Good questions.
Carter, question. If we if we find some samples, say we go to the Waco Mountain and find three deer to test, what then? What's the next step?
So I think one of the things we'll look at is what's the geographic distribution of those findings. Would that in any way have an impact on the proposed containment zone versus the high-risk zone? We'd ask the CWD task force whether or not there was sufficient basis to look at moving those lines and let them come back with some recommendations that we would certainly share with the commission on that front. Right now we're a CWD free state. I want to make that abundantly clear. We have not detected CWD in Texas. Again, obviously we believe this is a potential game changer with the detection of CWD within a mile or two of our borders. And so we have got to be more vigilant, and it certainly speaks to us getting out there and testing for it. I think we have a responsibility, not only biologically, but also to our hunters and landowners to let folks know what we're dealing with. And so part of it would be a communication plan to make sure that folks in that area and people that hunt in that area were aware of the presence of it if we do find it.
What kind of budget impact is this going to have just for the testing? I mean, if you're talking about testing every deer harvested in that county, I would assume that's going to have a budgetary impact.
Let me ask, I think there's a couple issues in terms of the cost of that test, and then, secondly, staff time working on this.
Right.
And so, no doubt we're going to have to figure out a way to staff these 100 check stations, and it's an opportunity cost. Now, we can't have all of our biologists and technicians working exclusively for several months in those check stations, and so we're going to have to figure out creatively how to handle that. Let me ask Mitch Lockwood to handle the issue associated with the cost of those tests. Mitch.
For the record, my name is Mitch Lockwood. I'm the game program director. For the last few years, we've received funding from USDA, specifically for CWD testing, and that has covered our cost for testing about 2,500 to 3,500 deer a year, and then other expenses associated with that, equipment and whatnot. That funding will cease to exist after this fiscal year, but I have identified some other funds available to allow us to continue surveillance at least into the next year. We've saved back some of those USDA funds that will, again, are good through August 31st. We still have sufficient funds at this time to do some of the active surveillance in the next month or so.
But most of your harvesting is going to be done this fall.
So the hunter harvest deer that we'll take in the fall, we do have source of funding to cover those costs for next fiscal year. I'm not able to look beyond next fiscal year at this time. But the costs are, just FYI, they're about $40 a deer, a sample, to run a test.
Not including staff time.
Not including staff time or other operating costs such as latex gloves and whatnot. But the actual lab expense is about $40 a deer.
I sort of don't advocate doing this, but I would, just as a point of reference, in Colorado, I know on elk deer there is you pay a fee, it's usually included in processing. Of course, that would apply if they're pretty processed out there. I don't know how you handle that, but I wouldn't think we'd even address that issue until we ever see any of it in our state. But that is that is one option going forward. If we ever are unfortunate enough to find any of it, we might address that testing fee, as part of the harvest deal on the tag or whatever.
We have learned a lot from the other states here in the last few months. You can imagine we've been on the phone quite a bit and learning from them. And Colorado, as you said, is one that they do charge a fee, or they take the fee from the hunters that submit the samples. However, it's interesting to note, I believe Colorado is the state that if the deer is detected, the CWD is detected in the deer, then the hunters actually refunded that amount. But I do think at this time, just looking into the next fiscal year, we're going to be able to cover the cost for this surveillance. And just to follow up to another question you had, Commissioner Scott, typically we get results back from TBMDL, the lab there at A&M, in about 30 days. Sometimes it's longer. And we do have information, and we'll collect information from hunters. And in the event that we do detect CWD in any deer, we certainly would notify the hunters. We currently do that when another state, when we have hunters come in from another state, and such as Colorado, and Colorado contacts us about a deer that a Texas hunter harvested, or an elk that in which CWD was detected, we contact the hunter and take them, a health commission actually makes an offer to go to that hunter's residence and retrieve to take the venison if the hunter wishes and dispose of it. Sometimes the hunters take us up on that offer, and sometimes they don't.
But chances are, I'm not a biologist, but chances are, if there's one been found within a mile of our border, there's probably one within our border. And I don't want to be the one, I don't want to jinx this.
Yeah.
But 1 mile is not that far.
It's not, Commissioner, and there, again, there's no deterrence that would preclude a deer from moving throughout those mountain ranges. And so, obviously, again, it speaks to the need for vigilance. It speaks to the need for acting very expeditiously to engage in more testing and to help setting up some boundaries to make sure we're doing everything we can to help contain the possible incursion and or spread into the state. It's a very serious issue.
Two questions, actually. One is, what are we doing to coordinate what you're proposing with New Mexico? What's New Mexico doing that's either consistent or inconsistent with what we're proposing? And the second question is it true that it cannot be transmitted by eating contaminated venison? I thought it could be. I had a fishing guy in Montana that died of it, and they said that's how he got it, because he ate some contaminated venison. So I don't know. I'm just asking this.
I like very clear in the response to that last question. There's no person that has ever been detected. CWD has not ever been detected in people. And there's no evidence that humans can get CWD, be infected with CWD. We obviously can't say that humans can't get it, but there is no evidence that humans can't. There are several different species that have been infected with CWD through intracerebral inoculation, but you know, there's a species of monkey that I don't remember the species offhand that I guess is closest to humans, genetically speaking, that they have not been able to infect CWD. So we do not want to send the message that we think humans can get it. At the same time, we just need to be very careful in how we deliver that message. As far as New Mexico's work, I'm not sure regulations that New Mexico has with respect. I do know that the hunters, those deer that were sampled this past year, 7 out of 10 hunter harvested mule deer in Game Management Unit 28, those were all voluntary check station, voluntary sampling. They've actually sampled 23 hunter harvested deer since 2007 and 8, detected CWD in 8 of those 23 deer. All of that has been voluntary. I'm not aware of anywhere in their state where they have mandatory sampling. I'm not aware of any captive deer facilities in their state or any program that allows them to trap and move deer in the state like we have. I just don't know if they have tools like that. What I can tell you as far as working with New Mexico is they have expressed interest in partnering with us and having I'll just say, cooperative plan on this. And we intend to visit, Sean Gray and I intend to go visit with our cohorts over New Mexico during the next several weeks.
Well, it seems like we ought to keep them posted and try to encourage them to engage in our program, don't you think?
Yeah. Yeah. We got one question. Contaminated site, once it's animal free, how long does it take?
That's a very good question, and the answer is I don't know.
I didn't hear it.
How long will a site remain contaminated? If there are deer at a site with CWD and then they're removed, how long will it remain contaminated? And there's still a lot unknown about chronic wasting disease, and that is one of the unknown factors, is how long environmental contamination will persist. It is in the period of years, I can tell you that, but we really don't know.
But I have one more question, kind of along the same line. How do we think it's transmitted from animal to animal?
I hesitate because there's also still unknowns regarding modes of transmission, but certainly through nose-to-nose contact. There's also indirect transmission through urine, feces, saliva, but certainly through direct contact, nose-to-nose contact, the disease can be spread. What makes this really challenging is the long incubation period that Carter mentioned. Even experimentally, since we know sites can be contaminated, but you cannot detect the disease, well, let me rephrase and say that 2 to 4 year incubation period, that's the length of time before an animal exhibits clinical symptoms. The disease can be detected in tissue sample at an earlier date, but it's still a long period of time, many months. And so the fact is since it is such a long period of time, we can't say with absolute certainty whether the animal contracted the disease through that direct nose-to-nose contact or through site contamination. Still a lot of unknowns.
Thanks, Mitch. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that note, just obviously we will keep you very, very closely apprised of our efforts on this, and we'll let you know what the plans are to get public comment and hold those public hearings down in West Texas, which we know are going to be very important. Mr. Chairman, the last issue that I have is just I want to distribute a report from Major Graham Jones. As you will recall, in the Sunset Bill of the Parks and Wildlife Department, we were required to provide an update on our internal affairs program. And so I have a written report from Major Jones that I want to submit to y'all. You can be assured that the Internal Affairs team continues its great work throughout the agency. If you have any questions about any of the incidents that are reported on this, please contact Graham directly, some of which are still ongoing, so obviously confidential in nature, but certainly if you have any questions, don't hesitate to talk to Graham. So, shut out. Mr. Chairman, with that concludes my remarks, unless anybody else has any questions on that.
Thank you. With that, I'll move on to committee item number 2, acceptance of land donation in Harris County, 2.5 acres of vegetation to Sheldon Lake State Park.
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, Corky Pullman with the Land Conservation Program. This is a donation in Harris County at Sheldon Lake State Park Education Center. We have a church that's adjacent to us that bought a 40-acre tract. They plan to build a new church on and develop the rest of the tract. In order to do that, they have to meet county requirements for their runoff. They have asked us to put a stilling basin adjacent to the property. This shows a little bit better of where it is in relationship to our boundary. We will take the runoff. Normally, we would have taken the runoff from this development. The lake can use it with drought and stuff, and even the runoff from this coming from the stilling pond into the park property is something that we gladly accept just for the water. In addition to us getting the water, which is what we do want, we're going to get a donation of around 2.5 to 3 acres as a buffer between us and the development. I'd be glad to take any questions.
Any questions? no further discussion, I'll place this item on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Committee item number three, acceptance of land donation in Ramsey County, 80 acres of state tree area of Goose Island State Park. Ted Hollingsworth.
Chairman, Commissioners, good morning. I'm Ted Hollingsworth with the Land Conservation Program. We're pretty excited about this item. We've been working with the Nature Conservancy for several years to try to find a means to acquire a tract of land that wraps around the big tree at Goose Island State Park, which is just north of Rockport. You can see from this map that the big tree is connected to the main body of the park by scenic drive. The actual area of the tree is only a 5-acre tract. The tree, in fact, spreads over much of that tract, and we've been very concerned about protecting it. And this particular ranch has been on the market several times over the years and is primed for development. So we've been working with the Nature Conservancy, and in the last few months have identified the means to acquire this. It's actually the MOEX settlement from the Horizon, the Deep Horizon well spill in the Gulf of Mexico. We've worked with the Department of Justice and the Attorney General's office here to propose that this tract be acquired as part of their restitution for their damage. One of the neat things about this tract is it is all critical habitat for the endangered whooping crane. It is probably the most popular spot now for people to drive to to see the crane without having to get in a boat and go up into the marshes. This will put that property in public ownership and make it a part of the state park. And we'll begin work immediately on a plan for a boardwalk trail and or observation deck where people will be able to get a good look at the birds. You can see the birds in the shallow water adjacent to the tract here. And the other neat thing about the property is that the western portion of the property does have a mature live oak gallery forest, and those forests are getting pretty uncommon on the coast, and they're extremely important for migratory birds. Bird fallout as they arrive in Texas after crossing the Gulf of Mexico. And this is a nice mature forest that was part of this property as well. But currently, the Nature Conservancy does have an option to buy on the property. We're waiting on the court to issue its final consent decree. Although the initial decrees has been issued, there's been no public opposition to the consent decree. We expect that to occur in June. And then we would do a concurrent closing where the property would go to the Nature Conservancy and from there to Texas Park and Wildlife at the same time. We think it's a terrific addition at no cost to the agency, and staff does recommend you adopt the following motion. The executive director is authorized to accept the donation of approximately 80 acres of land adjacent to Goose Island State Park for addition to the state park. Be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Looks like there's some infrastructure there. Is that you going to maintain that?
Yes, sir, that's correct. There are three or four old homes all in disrepair. There is a small landing strip and a hangar. I believe the hangar is in reasonably good condition, and we may be able to use it for maintenance facilities. On the other hand, this is all critical habitat for the endangered whooping crane. Anything we do by way of development or by way of allowing public access needs to be extremely sensitive to the birds. So we have not, obviously we haven't really begun the formal process of determining public use for the site. The homes do not contribute anything to the value of the land. Like you say, they're decades old and it's just repair.
Any questions? No further discussion. I'll place this item on the clerk's commission meeting agenda for comment and action. The next item is committee item number four, request for easement in Harris County, hydrocarbon pipeline, the state of Battleground, state of
Chairman, Commissioners, my name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This is the second reading of an item that you heard in March. We've had a request from Chevron to enlarge an existing easement across the San Jacinto Battleground State Historic Site. That current pipeline corridor contains five pipelines. They are, as many of the industries are in that area, they are trying to accommodate product coming from the shale and other places in South Texas. What they would, what they proposed to do is abandon one of those pipelines and add two more. There was the option of them operating within their existing easement, but it would have required open trench installation in a very narrow pipe field. The installation would have been risky and would have involved a lot of impact, visual impact, operations impact, and potentially resource impact. So we agreed to expand that easement as the minimum amount necessary in order to allow them to directionally drill those pipelines through the park. There will be three bore pits in the park as a result, but the route and the engineering have avoided all wetlands, all high quality habitats, all the areas where there actually is going to be soil disturbance, which is in those bore pits. It will be 100% tested for cultural resources. Here you can see a close up of that route and where those bore pits are. Those natural cultural resource surveys are underway. The Section 404 coordination is underway. State Historic Preservation Office is reviewing the project. They have all of the plans. They have everything that we have regarding the project. The soil testing is underway. The surveys and existing easements have been reconciled, and by that I mean nobody actually knew where those five pipelines were. Nobody actually knew where the boundary of the park was. And those easements go back to the 1920s. And so Chevron has worked very hard to identify those pipelines, identify the boundaries, and reconcile all of those records so that we know where those are in the future. And we know that those pipelines are within the easements they should be in.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. So just to make sure I'm clear, the easement that we're discussing here is for a pipeline that already exists. There's a 10-inch pipeline in the ground.
We'll discuss that in the next agenda item.
Oh, that's not on this one?
No, sir. This is a proposal to add two pipelines, and they'll be adjacent to the existing easement.
But isn't this the Sanderson Battleground Historic Site issue?
Yes, sir. This is item number four, request for an easement.
There are two different items.
Well, maybe I don't have four. I got five. And it was two. Maybe I'm missing a number, but it says to add two pipelines to the existing part of the park.
Yes, sir. To add two pipelines. That's correct.
Okay. So
there's an issue with the easement. I'm Ann Bright, General Counsel. If I can understand the question, there's an issue with the easement that's item number five. But in answer to your specific question, there is an existing pipeline that goes through the park, and this is just going to be expanding that quarter, that current quarter. Right.
Yeah, the original easement allowed for an unlimited number of pipelines. There are currently five. They will abandon one, and rather than try to shoehorn two more pipelines in an open trench situation into the existing easement, they have requested, and we have agreed with your concurrence, to expand the existing easement to give them room to install two new pipelines by directional drill.
Okay. And all I'm asking is, and if it's not time to ask this yet for item five, because I thought we were talking about this item since it dealt with adding two pipelines to the existing corridor. I'm just wondering why was there a mention of a 10-inch pipeline that has been installed since 1969 that lies partially outside the easement granted in 1969?
Well, that's a good question. That last bullet, survey of existing easements reconciled. When we did that survey, and it just so happened, because I spent so much time in the park, that I knew that the road, the recorded road, had never been surveyed, and that the easements corresponded to the road. And so one of the things we did early on is we had Chevron survey the park boundary, survey the boundaries of the road, and then survey identify and locate their existing pipelines. And in the course of doing that, we discovered that one pipeline that they assumed was within the road right-of-way and in their corridor was not. It wanders out of that corridor and under a portion of the park by just a few feet.
Okay, but is that pipeline active?
That is an active pipeline. That is a 10-inch pipeline installed in 1969 and still carries product.
Right. And are you asking us to grant them an easement for that pipeline? Because if it veers outside, then that means they don't have an easement.
That's correct. And item number five, we will.
Okay. All right. That's what I'm five. Okay.
We got there.
All right. Okay.
As for item number four, Chevron would like to, again, add two pipelines. They could add those technically inside their existing easement. We felt like it was much safer and would do less short-term and long-term impact to the park resources to directionally drill those. We've required directional drilling for all new pipelines for a number of years now. In discussions with the State Historic Preservation Office, they also prefer directional drilling, even though it means expanding the easement. And so our recommendation to the commission is that you adopt the resolution attached as Exhibit A, which would, in fact, allow the expansion of that easement to accommodate the two directionally drilled pipelines. And we have to answer any other questions.
Any other questions? No further discussion. I'll place this item on the third of the commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Move on to committee item number five. Definition of existing easement, Harris County Pipeline Corridor, St. Vincent's Battleground State Historic Pipe Site. Request permission to begin the public notice.
Chairman, Commissioners, my name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This item is related to the item you just heard. In the course of surveying the existing pipelines and the easement for those pipelines, which corresponds to the highway right-of-way, it was discovered that a segment of one of the pipelines that traverses the park is in fact not in the right-of-way that was granted in the 1920s and a subsequent easement that was granted in the 1960s, but in fact wanders out of that easement onto the park. That was not previously known because the road right-of-way, although it is recorded, had never been surveyed. We did require a survey of Chevron. They've been extremely cooperative. They were very candid about the fact that the pipeline wanders out of the easement and onto the park by just a few feet in a couple of locations. What we proposed to them is that we grant a new easement to cover that existing pipeline, that they pay full 2012 rate schedule rates for that pipeline, and that in addition, anytime they have to work anywhere in their easement, even where it is, anytime they have to work in the state park, even within their existing easements, that they pull a surface use agreement. That enables us to, again, in all future work on any of those pipelines, minimize those impacts to the park. Again, here's the recommendation. Chevron has agreed to all these terms and conditions. It'd be an easement for existing pipelines. It would be an after-the-fact easement. We think that that's the best response. It will enable us, again, to have better control over any activities that Chevron has to do to any of those pipelines in the park in the future. And staff request permission to begin the public notice and input process. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, well, this pipeline is a different pipeline than the red line and the previous line.
Right. It's the same corridor?
Well, you look back, you look on the slides before that. That pipeline is turned over at the road and goes.
Yes, sir, you're absolutely correct. The new pipelines will be dogleg out of the existing easement to avoid all this area of wetlands that's in that triangle formed by the two roads and the water.
Well, is this existing pipeline going to continue north?
Yes, sir, it sure does. It follows the road. It actually just north of that location, it actually strikes right out across the marsh.
East,
yes, sir, to the east, across the marsh.
Do we know where, do we actually know where that pipeline runaway is?
We know where the pipeline... Yes and no. the pipeline easement is in fact is not defined. Chevron has in fact just today updated the survey of where they would like us to agree the easement is, the 50 foot wide easement. They cannot locate those pipes without putting equipment in the marsh. They would prefer not to do that. We would prefer they not do that. This marsh has the highest concentration of green mottled ducks anywhere in southeast Texas, for example. It's a very sensitive habitat. We know approximately where the pipelines are. They know approximately where the pipelines are. We have reconciled all that information as best as we can without disturbing the marsh.
So, and we're not going to go ahead and survey.
We could require that. Staff recommendation is that the damage to the marsh would not justify that.
Thank you.
Let me just explore that last point just a bit.
Yes, sir.
I'm trying to weigh the importance of knowing where pipelines are that's on our property, which I think is an important thing to know, because if there is ever a time where you have to go out there and do something, dig, whether there's an emergency, I don't know why you would have to be out there digging around, but to me, it's important to know where the pipelines are. Now, but let me finish. But I've heard you mention a couple of times damage to the marsh, so I'm trying to weigh what damage to the marsh. What is the extent of the damage to the marsh if we're merely trying to figure out where the pipeline is? And maybe I don't understand how they figure out where the pipeline is. Maybe I don't understand how they do that. But to me, you would want to know where your pipeline is on your property. Always.
I agree, yes, sir. I believe we know where that pipeline is to within a few feet. Those pipelines are smart pigged every 5 years now. If there should be a need to get to the pipe, to repair, to preemptively work on that pipe to prevent additional corrosion or future spill, there would be damage to the marsh. But in that case, Chevron would have to pull a Section 404 permit. They would have to pull a surface use agreement for us. There would be considerable mitigation for impacts to those wetland resources at that time. Staff recommendation is that we don't preemptively disturb the marsh. Now, if the commission feels strongly about us undertaking the steps necessary to place those pipelines within a few centimeters on the ground, I'm sure Chevron would be willing to do that.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is help me understand what they have to do to identify where the pipe is that would disturb the marsh. What is that thing they have to do? Do they go out with a backhoe and stick it down there until they hit a pipe? I mean,
I honestly don't know. I don't know if they can remote detect those from the surface.
Because that's what I thought they could do. I thought there was a way to remotely detect where the pipe was that didn't disturb the marsh, at least in this.
And as curious as I've been, I have not yet asked them how it was that they located the pipes in the park. They've located those now exactly, where they're in the park, where they can get to them from the road, where they're not disturbing wetlands. And I don't know if they probe for them. I don't know if they metal detect for them. I don't know what that technology is.
Can you get that information to us?
I sure can.
Okay.
I should be able to get that to you tomorrow.
Because I'll just tell you where I am on it. And I'm not sure about anybody else, but my number one preference would be to know where the pipeline is. That's number one. Always know where the pipeline is. It runs on the property. Number two, unless determining that is going to unnecessarily and unreasonably disturb the marshland, and then we might have to just make do if we know approximately where it is. But I wouldn't want to make do without knowing exactly what I'm costing in terms of the disturbance of the marsh. So that's all.
I should be able to have that information for tomorrow meeting.
Okay.
The happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Any other questions? I will authorize the staff to begin the public notice of input process. Committee item number six, land acquisition, Stevens County, 640 acres of Pinto Mountain State Park. Request permission to begin the public notice of input process.
Chairman, Commissioners, my name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. We're real excited about this new state park, Palo Pinto Mountain State Park. At the time, we acquired that 3,333 acres last year. There were some available tracts adjacent to the park that we had to leave on the table because, quite frankly, we didn't have the funds to. We bought all the land we had funds to acquire. In the meantime, y'all have authorized the sale of a portion of the Fortress Cliffs Ranch at Palo Duro Canyon. And so we now have some land sale proceeds with which we can make some strategic additions to state parks. One of the state parks that we propose to do that is the Mother Neck, and you'll see that proposal tomorrow for action. Another one is Palo Pinto Mountain State Park. The Nall Ranch is, as you see on this map, it was our next priority for acquisition. We've worked very closely over the last couple of months with the heirs of that ranch. As it turns out, we have two willing sellers out of three at appraised value, and we have one sibling that is not a willing seller at appraised value. And so we have negotiated an option to buy two-thirds of that ranch. Any configuration, as you see in this map, it would give us all the high ground, pretty spectacular vistas of the surrounding countryside, as well as a significant portion of North Pelosianto Creek, and a large flat area, which quite frankly we don't currently have in the state park, which we believe would make a very nice day use area, picnic area. It's got some pretty pecan galleries in that flat floodplain of that creek. And again, we have negotiated an option to buy this acreage. We used proceeds from the Fortress Cliffs Ranch sale.
Oh, I didn't see that.
And if you are in agreement, we are requesting permission to begin the public notice and input process for that acquisition. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions or discussion? Being none, authorized staff to begin the public notice and input process.
Reed, before we go, can I ask a quick question?
Yes, sir.
Ted, if we, I know the third seller or the third owner is unwilling to sell at this time, have we attempted to get any type of option or ROFR from that person?
I am in fact working on that even as we speak.
Good.
And actually that property is on the market. It's posted, he's a willing seller. He's just not a willing seller at appraised value. Without wanting to go into much detail, we do have a potential donor who I'm taking out to see the property next Friday who may buy that and donate it. He's just not a willing seller. He just feels like the property ought to be worth a few hundred dollars more per acre than the appraisal says it's worth.
Thank you.
Richard, any other questions? We'll begin the public notice input process. Go to item number seven, lease termination, Jackson County, Lake Texana State Park. Request permission to begin the public notice input process.
Chairman, Commissioners, good morning. Still Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program.
Sure.
I am sure. I'm sure. I checked before I came this morning because I knew you were going to ask. This is the first reading of an item. As you know, under the terms of our land and water plan, staff is directed to evaluate our state park holdings and where it might make sense to transfer a park to another responsible operator to evaluate that and in some cases bring those to the commission for consideration. Lake Texana State Park is in central southeast Texas. It's just about 25 miles east of Victoria. It's not really close to anything except Lake Texana. 575 acres. It is healthy bottomland habitat. It's a pretty park. It has a lot of frontage on Lake Texana. Directly across the street, across Highway 111, is a park that's currently operated by the Lavaca Navidad River Authority. We've been talking to them for several months about taking over operations of Lake Texan State Park. In order for them to do that, we would simply need to terminate our lease. It's a 50-year lease. We've got about 15 years to go on that lease. We would simply need to terminate that lease, and if we did so, the Lavaca Navidad River Authority would take over operations of the park. As you can see here, that the park attracts 40,000 visitors or so a year. The LNRA tells us that they would operate that as they are operating Brackenridge Park across the street. Brackenridge is a little more intensely developed park. We have had one comment already in opposition for fear that they would overdevelop what now known as Lake Texan State Park. The experience is a little bit more below. It's not a wilderness experience, but it's a little more of a private experience at the state park. This is the proposal. Again, it simply would involve our termination of the lease that we hold. Staff does request permission to begin the public notice and input process for that divestiture. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
In response to that one opposition letter, I did read that. I'm sure everybody got it. Do we have any provisions, or would we want to have any provisions that keeps people that we're talking about leasing it or giving it over to keep them from overdeveloping? I'm a little familiar with that sure. area down there, so I'm just curious what our mindset is, since it is not nearly as intense on our part as it is on theirs right now.
Well, the mindset of staff is that the Lavaca Navidad River Authority owns this real estate, and by divesting ourselves of our lease, we, in legal terms, or I'm not an attorney, but we really have no property interest at all remaining. We have not contemplated, as far as I know, trying to tie any strings to that divestiture. And I don't believe the staff would recommend that, because it would require monitoring and potentially enforcement, which is something that we avoid putting ourselves in that position in the future where we can.
Just curious from that letter.
I have one question. When you go back to the map of where is the Breckenridge Park?
It's due south. Due south. You can see those facilities. They have a conference center. A large parking area they can accommodate and do accommodate conventions and things like that. They have, again, just more highly developed, more intensely developed facilities than at the state park.
How large is that? I'm not just asking.
Well, LNRA owns a large swath all the way around the lake, so I don't know that they actually put a boundary around that park and say the park is. I don't know if they identify Breckenridge as being a specific number of acres.
Any other questions? No further discussion. I'll authorize staff to begin the public notice and input process. At this point, the conservation committee would like to be
recessed.
Recess.
Okay, we'll recess. Thank you, Maureen. Let's recess conservation and go to finance. So let's turn it back over to Chairman Morian to resume.
Reconvene conservation committee. And at this time, I would like to announce that pursuant to the requirements of Chapter 551 of the Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act, an executive session will be held at this time for the purpose of deliberation of real estate matters under Section 551.072 of the Texas Open Meetings Act, and seeking legal advice under Section 551.071 of the Open Meetings Act, deliberation regarding personnel under Section 551.074 of the Open Meetings Act. We will now recess for executive session.